Do you know what nemesis means?
Hello and welcome to Direct, the podcast that takes a direct trajectory through a director's filmography. I'm Eric.
I'm Levi.
Kill Bill Volume 2 is the flick that we partook this week. Levi, in 30 seconds or less, give me your review of Kill Bill Volume 2.
I think that Kill Bill 2 demonstrates how Hollywood should be doing movies. It's the Kill Bill Volume 1 sets up the environment. It's the world building. And Kill Bill Volume 2 is just the nugget of the story. It is the revenge film, just perfectly simplified down to its core, and we get the satisfaction of Bill actually being killed.
Well, yes, the title comes to fruition. I have to completely agree with you here. When I ranked the movies last week that we had seen so far, I think I ranked Pulp Fiction 1, Jackie Brown 2, Reservoir Dogs 3, and Kill Bill Volume 1, 4. This movie kind of blew me away. Like, I don't know if I had seen this movie in about 10 years. And I just thought it was, like, so much of the great Quentin Tarantino stuff that I was really looking for in Kill Bill Volume 1. I thought it had great character, and the way that we get into the backstories of all these characters is so cool. Like, you get to go to Bud's work and see his asshole boss. L gets really fleshed out in this one as like a really evil person, and you're like really rooting for the bride, for Beatrix, to knock L out in this one. And Bill himself, like, he becomes a much more complicated character, which I really, really enjoyed. I thought just the character in general that was developed across this film made it really, really interesting. And even though it comes in at a 2-hour and 12-minute timeline, it kind of flew by for me. This movie's almost as long as Jackie Brown, and I felt like it didn't lull at all.
Yeah, they keep the momentum going. And you're talking about characters. I think the thing that's fascinating across the two films is how little they actually have to input to tell you about the characters. We don't see Elle for a lot of screen time, but we know she's a major league witch. based on the simple, when she does not poison the bride, and when she's in her coma, she gets all kind of huffy and puffy about it, and you're like, she's not that great. And it's a dishonorable action in a samurai film, essentially. And then in this one, her betrayal of Bud, and the fact that she kills Pai Mei, those three actions are enough to cement her as just good. Glad she's dead. Well, not dead, but her other eyes. Glad she's disabled.
I like to think that the Black Mamba finished her off.
Yeah, that's what I've always assumed.
Yeah. I mean, it's just like, her end is so satisfying because they build her up to be like the main villain in the movie, I think. Like, obviously Bill is the kind of prize at the end of the movie, but at the end of the film, when they sit down, when Beatrix and Bill sit down and they talk to each other and they talk it out, there's like a sadness that is hovering over it. Like, it's this weird tension of like they want to kill each other, but at the same time, they love each other. But they know, like, it has to be done. Like, it's one or the other. Bill becomes a very nicely fleshed out character in this film. And you really get to kind of understand his side a little bit.
A little bit. But you also get the sense that he's cruel. He is wildly cruel. Despite never seeing him kill anybody, or really, his actions are enough to, he's dangerous, and we're just not seeing that side of him because of his proximity to Beatrix.
Yeah, absolutely. And and you also hear him talk on the phone to Elle in the first film, and he kind of talks to everybody in like this very lulled tone and very calm and very zen-like. But at the same time, he himself, he's a self-described, cold-blooded killer. So he also trains these people to be as cold-blooded as humanly possible. I did want to touch on a couple of plot points, and then I'd like to just go into each of these characters because they're fleshed out so well. But it's interesting. So we open the movie on this on Beatrix breaking the fourth wall, talking to the audience and kind of giving them a recap of like where we've been and where we're going. I thought that this was a little bit off-putting to put it right at the beginning of the movie, just coming from Kill Bill Volume 1. But I think it's there for a couple reasons. I think, like we talked about in Kill Bill Volume 1, when they, you know, pop up with like the Klingon quote, and they have like the Shaw scope title slide. Like, I think that this wants to remind you again that like we're watching a movie. Like, this is a movie, and we're going to have this movie experience together. And it's done in this film by breaking the fourth wall with Beatrix in her car. And then we go to the wedding rehearsal. And I actually thought the wedding rehearsal was like probably the lowliest part of the whole film. I thought it was kind of interesting to start it off with the wedding rehearsal.
In black and white as well, which was a...
Mm-hmm.
You know, I understand the fight scenes in that black and white, but that particular scene does feel the oddest. And maybe, yeah. You know, if you watch these films, like the 4-hour back-to-back version,
yeah.
Maybe the breaking the fourth wall feels better as an intermission than it does the opening of a film. Because you're coming back and it's like, it's letting you know that the time has transitioned, you know, because it brings you in before the chapter.
Yes.
And it's the first, well, now I'm trying to think, you know, so many of his movies open with a title card of some sort, but right. This one comes in with the monologue and that's black and white. And then the scene at the chapel is black and white. And then we go into color when we get to, is it Bill and Bud, I think, talking.
Yeah, we don't go to color until basically the massacre happens, which is cool because the only time everything pre-massacre is and during the massacre is in black and white, and then the church, the only time we see the church in color is after the massacre when the sheriffs come in and Kill Bill Volume 1. So you could tell, like I said, like you could tell that this was shot in black and white as opposed to the scene at the club in Tokyo, which is, you could tell, was done in post. You know, the colors are just a little bit richer. The darks are a little bit darker. You could tell it was lit for that. It's also the first time that we see Bill's face, I believe, in this whole series. I think in the first film, all you see are his hands and you hear his voice.
Yeah, but they pulled the Emperor move where you don't see him right, which is awesome. I think more movies could. I hope that the new Star Wars trilogy has a long-term villain that you don't see until much later on. It's such a good trope for tension because you're waiting to see them.
I really wish, like, you know, I watched the Star Wars films when I was so young, and we don't have to go on a huge Star Wars tangent here, but I wish that I could see them, like, with new eyes at this point in my life, like, you know, seeing those little, you know, the little communicator holograms of the Emperor coming in and talking to Darth Vader, being like, who is that guy? Of course I knew who he was because I'd seen Return of the Jedi, like, but before I could even comprehend the whole series. So I knew who the guy was, but it would be, I think you're completely right. Like, I love how it's like a slow reveal to David Carradine, which is super cool.
Yeah, have you seen the old Kung Fu TV show?
I have not, but I want to.
I've seen a couple episodes. It's pretty cool. It's a nice concept.
I mean, Carradine he's pretty badass in this whole series, and he does, you know, he's a little bit of a sympathetic character, which is hard to do with a guy that's this big of an asshole, which I really like. Plus, I love the callback because, you know, at the end of Pulp Fiction, Samuel L. Jackson says he wants to roam the earth like Kane in Kung Fu. And then you have Kane in Kung Fu in this movie.
And then you have Samuel Jackson show up as a drifter.
Yeah, but that's the problem. Like, I feel like Samuel Jackson was completely wasted in this movie.
Well, I think he probably had, I mean, the guy acts in so much. It was bound to happen that You know, you couldn't get him in for a larger role.
Yeah, that's understandable. But yeah, man, like the whole beginning scene with the rehearsal is just kind of like, I don't really like the dialogue. I don't like the preacher and his wife going through the wedding thing. There's this whole speech about like the bride's side and the groom side and who's on the bride's side, but it's like I was trying to kind of uncover like what that all meant, because they mentioned the bride's side like four or five times, but it doesn't really make a ton of sense because nobody's on her side.
Yeah, but it's trying to reinforce the, you know, it's, they kind of bookend this fact that she is a killer first and foremost, and so her at this wedding with people who are ostensibly friends but really are just, you know, they seem awkward. I would be curious to know if it was intentional that this, the awkwardness of this whole setup, the low energy compared to when, you know, Bill goes into his exposition at the end about how she's the rogue killer bee. She does not fit in. She is Superman, and her pastiche of daily life is not real.
Yeah. I think you're right, because it is kind of boring. Like, this opening scene is kind of boring. You know, it's got the Quentin Tarantino dialogue in it, but the actors aren't very good. But then you're right. Like, maybe they're trying to illustrate this boring life that Beatrix was marrying herself into. And you really get to understanding that at the end of the film. I like that take a lot. But, you know, regardless, the thing is that Tarantino, like I said, he knows his fans are kind of hungering for what he's going to do next. And I think he can play with that a little bit and kind of open with a little bit of a lighter scene, as opposed to like the first movie where you open up with a fight scene, you know, but you can open up with a little bit of a lighter scene. You know, people are still going to be on board for what's next, which I, you know, he's got a little bit of the audience manipulation technique going at this point, which I have to appreciate, because I did think that this film was super strong.
I think it's just a compliment to how he's a movie watcher. You know, he makes the movies that he wants to watch. And so I agree. I think he manipulates the audience, and I think it's because he is such a big name. That's his thing. Like, it's his life is watching movies.
Well, he's got a weird you know, status even for a film director. There aren't many film directors that people know by name, even. You know, there's like Wes Anderson, you know, Quentin Tarantino, and then Steven Spielberg, of course, you know. But these really stylized directors, in order to get that kind of credibility, you have to really, you know, deliver over and over and over again on similar themes and similar storylines, but reinvent them and make them new each and every time. And, you know, Quentin Tarantino falls into that small category that drives kind of a cult following. And then he can leverage that cult following to, you know, take them on these cinematic journeys, which I appreciate. You know, I think he's got that real strong understanding of who his audience is and how he can manipulate them, which is cool. Because his audience is basically himself.
And us.
One other plot point I wanted to hit on this, man. The buried alive scene is crazy intense.
The Texas funeral.
Yeah. Like, that is terrifying on so many levels.
It's the one scene I think of whenever I think of this movie is the buried alive scene.
Yeah.
And I think I can actively remember points in my life where I put my hand on a wall that's like right in front of me and then do like the fist move and go, I wonder if I could.
Yeah. I love that. Yeah, that like the 3-inch punch too, because that's like, that's a callback to Bruce Lee. Like, he had this 3-inch punch move that he would do, which was like, became famous. So I liked how that was like a little bit of a nod there. But man, like, the when it goes to pitch black and then you just hear like the sounds of them dropping her into the grave and then the dirt flying on top, man, it's just like, oh, I don't count myself as somebody who's very claustrophobic, But man, that scene is so claustrophobic because you're experiencing it at the same time as Beatrix. It's pitch black, and all you could do is hear the dirt falling and getting more and more muffled as it gets, you know, deeper and deeper on top of you. I thought it was so good. And then, you know, then we go to the Pai Mei scene. And Pai Mei is awesome. We had somebody on the forums kind of comparing Pai Mei to Sonny Chiba in Kill Bill Volume 1. But I feel like they kind of serve different purposes. But what did you think of the Pai Mei training sequence?
I don't know what it is that Tarantino does to get the texture of the film just right, but mm-hmm. I love he starts with like the myth of Pai Mei with Bill telling her the story around the campfire. I think that's awesome. This perfectly, you know, he gestures to the monk and the offense when the monk does not return it. And they give us this cool, like the five finger death punch, which is a nice callback to kind of the absurdity of older kung fu films. At the same time, it's foreshadow. And I don't think I caught it when I first watched the movie, like the first time in the theaters. But it's such a nice one. It's a nice break from the claustrophobia of the grave. And when it transitions, you know, because she freaks out, she's banging on the roof of the thing, she's panicking, she keeps hitting the flashlight and it keeps like going out, and then she just doubles her panic. And then as we transition into the Pai Mei story, she actively, like, you hear her click the flashlight off. And it's just this fantastic cut to a training montage, basically, which we don't get from Tarantino ever. So that's always a ton of fun. And the character Pai Mei is just so well written in that classic master role. You know, he's funny in how he teaches her, but it culminates when you find out that Elle has killed him. Right. And then you find out that he taught Beatrix the punch. You understand just tangentially that he is truly a great master, truly a great teacher. And most of all, he is a truly a good judge of character. And that's why he never taught Bill it. And he certainly didn't teach Elle almost anything, which is why she gets her eye plucked out again.
Yeah, I love that they go to this training montage and it's super weird. Like, we set it up. This guy is like 1,000 years old at least.
Yeah, one double on three.
Yeah, one double on three. Which is alive.
1,000 years almost exactly from the release of the film in 2000. From the first one would have been 2003.
Yeah. So, yeah, one double on three. So he's 1,000 years old and he's super temperamental. And I love how, like, the first real, you know, past the story, the first real introduction that we get of him is when Bill comes back and his face is all beat
he's all screwed up.
Yeah, and he goes, you know, he's like, yeah, he'll train you.
Friendly competition. Yeah. Hates Caucasian, like, loathes American, despises women.
And then, yeah, we go up and we see like this old dude. And this is, you know, I thought it was really cool. I had to look this up afterward, but this is the same guy. This is Gordon Liu. He played Johnny Moe, who was the leader of the Crazy 88s as well.
Yeah, I caught that looking through the IMDb cast list. I didn't realize that they had doubled up.
Yeah, I thought that was awesome. So he's actually, he's in two different parts of the film. He's the leader of the Crazy 88 and he's Pai Mei. It's so interesting because Pai Mei is also like a huge asshole.
Well, but everybody but the child is just in one way or another a terrible human being. I mean, this is a squad of assassins trained by this cruel, like they even titled the chapter "The Cruel Tutelage of Pai Mei." So it's weird because you do come to like these characters despite their weird shortcomings.
Yeah, I mean, we talked about it earlier. Like, bad people are more interesting than good people. I think Quentin Tarantino, that's definitely a Tarantino-ism, is that we're just going to make everybody in the movie bad so that you don't have anybody to root for from a moral standpoint, and then we can just develop their characters. So I think that that's really cool. Or we create our own special morality around the scene. You know, the one that really comes to mind is the Butch sequence in Pulp Fiction. Like, we're going to create a strange morality play around all of these terrible people. But yeah, he's such a jerk. But then at the same time, when you find out that Elle killed him, you're like, why? Everybody loves Pai Mei.
It's probably the laugh and the beard.
Yeah, I know, man.
And then he sweeps his beard.
I love how he sweeps his beard every time he's like a little bit pleased. He just does like a little bit of a beard. Like when, you know, when Beatrix's hand is basically broken and she can't even hold chopsticks, but then she like fights her way to eating a bowl of rice and he just does a little flick of the beard.
This scene,
like, you're improving.
Also, the whole Pai Mei setup is really the only background we get on Beatrix. We get nothing about her childhood, no explanation as to why she has become a super... Orenishi's really the only one where we get an explanation as to why, you know, how she kind of ended up in this lifestyle. But this is as far back as we go with Beatrix. Is, oh, Bill dropped her off to train with this super cool guy. And even going in, she claims to be proficient with things.
Yeah.
I do love Pai Mei's when he grabs her arm backwards and twists it and nearly breaks it. And then he goes, this is my arm. I want it strong. It's this parent move of, I've got your nose. I'm going to do with it as I please.
That's perfect. Yeah, man. I love the whole Pai Mei training sequence. And then it's so good because it illustrates really effective nonlinear storytelling. Because it reveals all these things to you very slowly. Like the whole Beatrix, you know, trying to punch through the solid wood. And then, like, doing it so much that she does in her sleep. And doing it so much that her hand is basically mangled. And then when you cut back to the coffin, you're like, oh, okay, now I know what's going to happen. Now I know why we went to that training sequence at that point. Like, it does a couple of things super effectively. It relieves this incredibly intense scene. I would venture to say that the burial scene is one of the most intense scenes that Quentin Tarantino had shot up to this point. Like, it puts you on edge as a viewer, and then it relieves you with a little bit of comic relief and, you know, this beautiful, you know, setting, but then brings you right back to, like, this is why we cut away, so that you know that Beatrix can punch through this coffin and get up to the top. And then she has her superhero moment where she, you know, her Neo moment where she rises through the ground.
Yeah, they don't mention in the training montage where she learned to punch through, you know, 6 feet of dirt, but you watch her crawl through it in this weird sideways section view. But you ignore it, like, because the movie has established that they're just oddities to the laws of physics in this world.
Right, exactly. And the other thing is that Beatrix really is a superhero, man. I feel like she is like a superhero. I know I said I had my stupid fan theory that Reservoir Dogs is Quentin Tarantino's Marvel movie, but I actually think, like, this is his superhero movie. Like, she has so much, and it's pulled off really well. Like, nobody, she goes into a club filled with maybe 88 assassins, maybe not, and she murders all of them. And then she, you know, she basically can win a fight against the best assassins in the world. And she comes out on top every time, and you never doubt it. You're like, we're on board. Like, she is a superhero, but it's pulled off so effectively that her superpowers don't get boring. And I think one of the reasons why is because she gets her ass kicked in these fights, too. Like, they are even fights. And it always seems like she just kind of comes out just a little bit ahead. And that's the difference, which, well, I think is really good.
Even the first half of her fight with Elle, it wasn't like... For all of the training montage you see and all of the kung fu you've seen, it's a brawl. I mean, they're just throwing each other around Bud's trailer. It's not really a... It's not the sword fights that we're used to. It's just knees and elbows and throws. And so you get a different fight every time. Oren Ishii, the samurai showdown, the crazy 88, uh-huh. you get your large-scale massacre. But she does not actually kill herself. Vernita Green is right. just the quick knife yeah. throw. Everybody
but it's also
dies
a great brawl. Yeah, I mean, this one is on par with Vernita. I'd like to go to the forums real quick because there's a couple things that I'd like to touch on in terms of the fights that are in this movie. One of them, you know, comes for us from Shum in Utah. I don't know if Shum is male or female, but Shum says, the fight with Daryl Hannah was cool, but I couldn't help but compare it to the fight with Vivica A. Fox, which was way better. So that's one take. And then our buddy Davey Mack from Tokyo, he says that he loves the fight with Elle because it's the trailer almost becomes a character in itself, which I thought was really cool. Because, like, yeah, it's a trailer, man. It's got paper-thin walls. You just, like, throw people through the walls. You know, they're probably made out of some kind of composite cardboard. So you could do that, and it just leaves the whole place in shambles.
Well, and the tight confines. I mean, you're drawing your sword, a 3-foot sword,
yeah,
in an 8-foot wide trailer, like, you don't have a lot of room by the time you get your arm span, you get the back span. I mean, you're talking, if that sword blade is 3 feet, then the sheath is 3 feet. So to get both separated, you need 6 feet. You have 2 feet left for your hand. And it just, there's a couple moments, and I always think about that now when I see movies where they fight in confined spaces. It's like, you know, the, it's drastically a different way of fighting.
Yeah, it's great. I do love how it gets compressed like that. And the other thing that I love, and I mentioned it last week, is Quentin Tarantino's fight scenes. I feel like they're really good length. Like, you know, there's this, I think that maybe I've just become accustomed to modern action films where fight scenes last like 15 minutes. And you know, there's good length on these fight scenes, specifically the fight scenes with Vivica A. Fox's character and with Elle in this film. You know, there's good length and there's good violence and good brawling. And that, like I said, gets you to the point where you're like, yeah, these people are on par with Beatrix. Beatrix gets her ass kicked a little bit in all of these fights. And then she comes back for the death blow. But the death blow always comes almost as a surprise, which I think is great. Like, there's no huge buildup to a moment. It's kind of like, boom, split second, she gets the best of them, and then they're done. And God, when she plucks Elle's eye out, it is, like, so satisfying, because Elle is the worst.
Right? And she is, and there's very little reason to hate Elle so much, but having her lose her other eye and just the way that Daryl Hannah just flails is amazing.
Yeah.
But it's that the vigilante justice that you've come to know and love from Tarantino. You're like, yeah, she got hers.
Well, I love how it's, you know, she, like, when Beatrix got to Pai Mei, she was fighting with the tiger technique, tiger crane. Is that what it is?
Yeah, tiger. Some crane.
It's the tiger something.
She has, I thought, like, it was the tiger claws. Claw and something,
yeah,
crane.
Yeah, and Pai Mei, he's got, like, the crane technique. And then when Beatrix goes into the fight with Elle, Elle is using that tiger technique, and you're like, uh-oh. Like, she didn't learn that technique from Pai Mei that Pai Mei used to best that tiger. It was the tiger crane style back in the day.
Oh, what Eagle's Talon. Or Eagle's Claw.
Oh yeah, the Eagle's Claw was Pai Mei's, and the Tiger Crane was Beatrix's. Just in case you want to put that in your Quentin Tarantino dictionary. But it's great. I love how she comes at her with the tiger claws, and you're like, oh shit! Like, she never learned from Pai Mei. Like, she she basically, you know, just shunned the old man. He didn't teach her anything, and then he plucked out her eyeball, and then she poisoned him. And, you know, she kills, this is like the third time in the, she tries to kill people with venom like 3 times in the movie. Like, she tries to poison Beatrix in the first film, she poisons Pai Mei, and she kills Bud with the venom from the snake. So she's, you know, she's wily, she's a poisoner, but she's really no match because she, I don't know. I feel like she's the type of person, she has everything figured out, but she feels like she has everything figured out, and that's like her greatest weakness, is that she doesn't think she has any weaknesses.
I think you. I think there's also a sense of honor, oddly enough, mm-hmm. to all of these. Like, I don't really feel bad when Bud dies. I think he goes in a crummy way, but yeah. at the same time, he didn't fight Beatrix honorably. He shot her with rock salt and buried her. And even
well, he fought her in the way, because he wouldn't have been able to match her in hand-to-hand combat, I don't think.
Yeah.
So he had to be a little bit smart about it. But yeah.
At the same time, even that was an oddly emotional move, because, you know, right before he buries her, he's like, this is for breaking my brother's heart.
Yeah.
And despite the fact that Bud and Bill are fighting, which, one more strike against Bill, just everybody hates Bill between Hattori Hanzo and Bud and Beatrix and all the people that, and Pai Mei apparently not really taking a liking to him either.
Right.
Between all those people, you learn that despite Bill's kind of charm, that he's really not a good person. But there's so much around like Bud and his actions that make him a sympathetic character. Like, he's trying to hurt Bill by saying he hawked the sword, but he still has it. Like, when she finds out, I was like, oh, he does still love Bill, you know, in a weird
brotherly way.
But is it in a brotherly way? Because even that's vague. Like, it sounds like Bill has slept with every one of the deadly vipers as he recruits them.
I don't know if he killed it. I don't know if he slept with his brother. I think that's a bit of a
stretch.
But he
says, the only man I've ever loved.
Yeah, because he's his brother.
Are they?
Yes, they're brothers. Did you not pick up on that? They say it like four times.
Your brother. Yeah, but they might be using it in like a monk way.
Okay. That's fine.
Brother in arms. You could take, I don't know.
You can take that however you want. That might be your crappy fan theory. No, but I'm completely on board with you with this Bud character. Like, first of all, Michael Madsen kills it. Although he does pretty much act it in almost the exact same way as he did Mr. Blonde. but I feel like he did really well, and we do see his backstory. We see where he's at in his life. He's working at the crappy strip club. He's got his boss is up his ass. And I love the scene when he's in the strip club and his boss basically says, don't come back until I call you. And then he's like, oh, and by the way, Rocket's got a job for you. Go talk to her before you leave. And you're like, oh, so he's like doing jobs on the side as like an assassin or something. You know, he's doing some underworld jobs on the side. And then he goes out and Rocket's job is that somebody, you know, shit all over the floor in the bathroom and he has to go clean it up. And this is what his life is now. So I just thought that was they build him up to be a little bit more of a sympathetic character. And also the fact that, you know, Beatrix doesn't actually directly kill him. And I feel like the Texas burial, I feel like he kept her alive for a reason. I feel like he did that to give her an opportunity to escape. But I'm not really sure.
I thought, like, it was just suffering was his goal for her death because of what she put Bill through.
I mean, how would you even die like that? I mean, would you die of starvation or would you die of asphyxiation?
Asphyxiation is how you go.
Oh, God. Well, it's actually not that bad, though, because you just kind of pass out.
Jeez.
I'm just saying, like, you know, Elle wanted her to suffer to her last breath. I feel like asphyxiation is a little bit of a lighter way to go as opposed to like a more torturous way. I don't know. I mean, being locked in a coffin 6 feet under the ground is pretty torturous. I understand that, but there's things that he does. Like, he, you know, he's like, I could mace you in the eyes, and you'd be blind, but instead I'm going to give you this flashlight. Like, he leaves her alive, which, you know, in any hero story, you never leave the hero alive. I've seen enough James Bond stories that you never, like, assume that he's dead and then leave the room, you know? So he gives her a little bit of an out. And I do like the fact that even though he didn't get killed by Beatrix, he does get killed by a Black Mamba. So there's the correlation there between Beatrix and Black Mamba, which is good. Yeah, I mean, I feel like he was a little bit of a sympathetic character. The other thing, though, is that he's as cold-blooded as everybody else, because this idea that, like, she deserves her revenge, but also she deserves to die. Like, I never really got the feeling that Beatrix deserved to die, apart from just a sheer brutality of these people. Like, leaving to go marry a guy, that's enough betrayal to warrant a death sentence?
Well, Bill did say he overreacted. In one of the great lines of the movie.
Yeah. I mean, that's one of the saddest parts about the whole thing, and I think that's one of the reasons why, even though Bill has his little redemptive story at the end, he still deserves the death sentence, is because he didn't just kill Beatrix, he killed, like, a bunch of innocent people in a church. Like, all of her friends that she had made over that time period, like, she'd moved to a new town. She seemed to have, like, a really cool little group of friends that she'd made. And those were the people who all got, you know, just massacred. They didn't have a single chance in the whole matter, which makes it, you know, makes it okay, in my view, for Bill to get the five-finger punch at the end of the movie. You know, so we went through L. Sorry, go.
I was just going to say about Bill, one thing that I just thought of is the fact that, you know, he tells that whole Superman story about Beatrix and the analogy with the costume and how... But Bill also just operates under, like, the Dostoevsky version of the Superman theory. Like, I don't know that he feels any wrong in killing... essentially non-characters in a movie sense.
Yeah. Everybody is expendable. And also zero cops, once again.
Yeah. No the cops show up and go, this is weird. She's still alive. All right, we're out.
Peace out, guys. I want to touch on one thing in the fight scene with Elle in the trailer. One thing that I really loved was that when Beatrix sticks Elle's face in the toilet to try to drown her,
yeah,
Elle just flushes the toilet, which I was like, because we've seen this so many times in movies, like the stuffing somebody's face in the toilet. I just love the idea that, oh yeah, you just flush the toilet and then you can breathe again. Like, this very good move. Like, I swear, you could almost see the wheels turning in Tarantino's mind when he was putting that together, that he's seen this so many times in movies of the stuffing the face in the toilet, and that why don't you flush? Just flush it. I thought that was really good.
I'm curious how much he's doing the choreography versus, like, how much input he has into the choreography.
Yeah.
Because a scene that's this creative, like, in the trailer.
Oh, yeah.
And with the crazy 88, you know, he has a very specific vision with how these fights occur and kind of conclude. Mm-hmm. I wonder where the choreography of the choreographer versus Tarantino kind of start and stop. That'd be something I'd really love to see.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure, you know, he I feel like this was kind of like a dream for him. In the very long post-credit sequence. I mean, in the very long end credit sequence. So we basically get three end credit sequences. But, you know, you see that he shot in China. He was shooting with, you know, fighting aficionados, stunt aficionados in Asia. Like, I feel like this was a really big opportunity for him to, like, go and pay homage to all of these awesome movies and awesome stunt people and this whole genre that has been, you know, a little bit overlooked, I think. I feel like there was this time in the 90s when it was really cool. Like, Hong Kong cinema was really cool when Jackie Chan was really big. And then, you know, and now in modern day, it's kind of fell to the wayside in its place. Instead of, like, these cool long shot action sequences, we're getting these quick shot action sequences, which, you know, to me basically shows that the actors don't really know how to fight, and so you have to go quick cuts over and over and over again. For anybody out there who wants to learn a little bit more about this Hong Kong cinema, there's this series online on YouTube called Every Frame a Painting, and he goes into Jackie Chan's action comedy and kind of talks about the differences between Hong Kong action sequences and Western action sequences. It's really good, and I just really like how Quentin Tarantino is obviously paying homage to these Hong Kong action sequences, which is great. So we went through L, we went through Bud, and we went through Pai Mei. Let's talk about Bill here. So, specifically, I love Bill's final action sequence, or final, you know, monologue sequence where he's talking about Superman, because it illustrates the point super well. And this is also a point in time when I think Spider-Man had been released, but the whole superhero movie was not, like, apparent at this point. And, you know, you talked about it in last week's podcast. This movie has so many comic book elements that I thought it was great to end it with a comic book monologue.
The Superman comment is always one I kind of remember, and I always pair it with Unbreakable, with the, mm-hmm. the notion of comics as kind of a cultural storytelling.
Yeah.
And I just, it's a fantastic, and it shows, I think, the whole, because I think when we talk about Bill, especially in this last scene, we should also include BB a little bit, because yeah. everything he says and influences upon her, just, it's, I think it's subtle, and maybe I'm even misinterpreting, but it seems like he's grooming BB to be an assassin. Like,
oh yeah,
she, like, Beatrix walks in and they're playing with guns, and you know, he talks about BB being impervious to bullets, like giving the child the sense at such an early age. And then he puts it, you know, he does the fish story and death, mm-hmm. and relates it to him shooting BB's mom, and BB's just like, oh, okay, yeah, I got that. He uses yeah. comic books, which are, you know, they can be adult in nature, but they are a media that is accessible to children. You know, he uses right. that to describe, to justify, you know, how they act. And it's just beautiful. The whole scene as he kind of lays all of this out, this explanation. Oh, she watches Shogun's Assassin. You uh-huh. know, not a kid's movie.
Not a kid's movie.
But all of this yeah. stuff just leads me to believe, like, he is just, you know, they call him the snake charmer at the end, and he mm-hmm. really is. Like, he's just, and we don't ever see his moment of true evil, which leaves us just with this guy who talks about comic books and plays with his kid, and but everything he does just, it feels like a subtle manipulation.
Oh, he's so emotionally manipulative. He's so crazy manipulative. It's insane. Like, you know, there's the scene when Beatrix comes into the hotel room and you're expecting, you know, this kind of like, oh, Rennie, she showdown. She turns the corner and it's Bill and BB just sitting there with their toy guns, like, waiting for her. And yeah. And then, like, in a moment, she turns from, like, this person coming as an assassin to this person who's faking dying because BB shot her. And this is, like, her introduction to her daughter. It's like, it's crazy. And the thing is, like, BB knows that Beatrix is her mom, like, right away. Yeah, there's such an emotional manipulation there. But then at the same time, Beatrix knows the whole time that she's here to kill Bill. And if that doesn't happen, Bill is going to kill her. It's like these moments where she, like, goes and sits down in the living room, then goes to reach for the sword, and then he already has a gun on hand. He almost shoots her. Like, this relationship is going to end in the death of one or the other of them, regardless. Now, do you think that Bill wanted to kill Beatrix in this final scene, or did he just know that it was either him or her? And so that was why he had this kind of, you know, this death wish against her as well.
You know, now that you ask that, I did not consider that he may have well accepted that he was going to die, and that this was really his opportunity. You know, like, he cannot live without her. And so,
yeah,
he tried to kill her. You know, that was his most masochistic, you know, that was him punishing himself the uh-huh. most. That's where I learned the difference between masochism and sadism, was that line.
Oh. So masochism is punishing yourself and sadism is punishing other people?
Yeah. Yeah. Or, like, getting off on that particular action. Mm-hmm. But you know, now that you pose that, I wonder if he accepted he was going to die, but he wasn't going to do it lightly. You know, he,
yeah.
I'm trying to think of who made, cause he makes the first move when they're out at the back table.
Yes, he does.
He sweeps he across the table. The she leans back.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
yeah, there's, and he also lets her bring her sword out to the patio, which I think is interesting. Like, I think he knows that this is where the showdown will happen. And then, yeah, there's kind of this beautiful moment after she does the five-finger punch and he knows that he's dead, where they can sit there, and it's this interesting, you know, thing in cinema and in storytelling. The, you know, the one that it goes back to for me is Romeo and Juliet, like, when Romeo takes the poison and right before he dies, he sees Juliet wake up, and there's this like moment where they could be together even though one of them is on the road to death and there's nothing that either of them could do about it. But this moment here is very similar in that, you know, Bill knows that he's dead. Like, the second that happens, Bill knows that he's dead, and then they could sit there and say goodbye to each other, and then he takes his walk and that's it. Like, you know, he could have just gotten a wheelchair. He'd be fine. Just saying.
And over the course of his life, he gets to make 5 steps.
Well, it'd be great, but at any point, he can decide that it's all over. He knows exactly what he needs to do.
That's a weird conjecture.
Well, like, what is it? Like, when he stands up, does that count as a step? Because, like, would he be able to get into bed? What if he sleepwalks? That's a problem. So many questions here, Bill. No, but it really is this beautiful scene. Like, she has a tear. You know, she sheds a tear at the end because it's this weird love story. This is like a weird-ass love story between Bill and Beatrix. They really do love each other, but their love is lethal. It's this weird thing of, like, they can't be together, and because of that, then one of them needs to die. It's such a strange dynamic between two lovers that it's like, yeah, it's just so weird.
And it's entirely because of BB. Like, that's the,
yeah.
This is the ultimate story of it. When the child, you know, when your parents get divorced and you say, the kid asks, was it my fault? This was BB's fault, really. Because,
yeah.
Beatrix could no longer do the assassin lifestyle because she was going to be a mom.
Yeah, it was so interesting too. I'd love to talk about that last scene when the what was her name? Was her name Monica? I can't remember what her name was. The assassin comes in and they have like that weird, like weird comedic scene that breaks up the conversation between her and Bill, where the assassins are like firing at each other. And then the pregnancy test is there, and one of them checks the pregnancy test and then leaves. Yeah. It's like,
congratulations, through the hole in the door that she shot with her shotgun.
Yeah, exactly. Like, these people are supposed to be cold-blooded assassins. Like, really? Like, finding out that one of them is pregnant is going to stop you from carrying out your job?
So here's,
I don't know.
Here's the question. If, you know, because I think this maybe kind of explains all of the characters. You talk about the cold-blooded assassin, but nobody is really that cold-blooded, with the exception maybe of Elle and Bill, because how many of them are still assassins? Vernita Green has gone and gotten married and basically has the life that Beatrix wanted. And she,
that's true.
And she basically left somehow. Bud, you know, for whatever reason, had some sort of emotional tiff with Bill and is now like a low rent bouncer. You know, everybody moved on. Oranishi moved on to become a kingpin of the underworld, no longer really like an assassin by trade. Everybody has moved on with the exception of Elle and Bill.
Right.
And that's, maybe that's it. It's like everybody eventually falls out. And we're kind of seeing all of the different ways you could fall. What do you do in a world where you were an assassin, killing people, gallivanting around the world, making vast sums of money? What do you do after that? What do you do when your humanity catches up with you?
Yeah, man. Well, and I think that the implication there, too, is that Elle was with Bill. Because, you know, when she calls him from the hospital room, he says, like, come home, baby. I think that's what he says. And that's what I think that's why it's so cool, because, you know, Elle basically is the alter, or not the alter ego, but the that kind of polar opposite villain that you want in a superhero movie. Like, she went through the same training, but she couldn't hack it. She's with Bill as well. You know, and she's super, I think her whole thing is built off of this jealousy around Beatrix, because Beatrix is kind of this, like, you know, she's Bill's favorite. She's kind of this, like, pure of heart assassin. And that's the reason why, that's ultimately, like, her downfall, is because Bill can't live without her. Like, he's got this crazy infatuation with her. And it's something that Elle will never be able to live up to. And that makes Elle resent Beatrix to the point that not being there to kill her gives her regret. Yeah, just these great balancing acts there. So let's end with Beatrix, man. So we've seen Beatrix now for this entire film series. What is your final take on Beatrix as a character? Because I feel like she's surrounded by so many great characters in these movies that she almost becomes our invisible, you know, tour guide throughout this kind of crazy scene. But she's also got great emotional you know, resonance, and I think that all kind of comes together at the end of the movie when she's looks like she's bawling, looks like she's crying on the bathroom floor as her daughter's watching cartoon, but then you realize that she's actually laughing in full relief because she's finally free. But what's your take on Beatrix?
I mean, she is revenge incarnate, and in so many instances for movies, there's you get the weird sort of revenge at the end. It's never quite the just like a straight killing. For a lot of movies, there's always like a moral tale about, oh, but you know, they left them alive to go through the justice system because that's the right form of, you know, despite revenge, right, they deserve, you know, their fair day in court or whatever.
Right.
This one, she truly does. She kills her way all the way to Bill, kills him, and she's done. And that final moment is her, you know, she is finally released. She can be just a mother, and, you know, who knows if she's going to be any good at it, honestly.
Well, this is the crazy thing.
What is their next step?
Yeah, she admits that would have been her alter ego of going out and being, you know, what she thinks society thinks that she should be. I really love that line from Bill when he was talking about Superman, and he's like, who is Clark Kent? He's cowardly, you know, all this stuff. He's actually a reflection of what Superman sees in humanity. He sees humans as cowardly and weak. And it's like, holy crap, man, that's really, first of all, it's an awesome, strong take on Superman that you don't usually hear about. But second of all, that's what Beatrix ultimately sees as like her normal life. She's a born cold-blooded killer. And I don't know if she's going to be happy just cruising around with BB. Like, I, you know, there's been talk of you know, Kill Bill Volume 3. And by the way, Quentin Tarantino, it's time and time again, has denied that he actually wants to make this movie anytime soon. But the you know, presumed premise of Kill Bill Volume 3 would be that Vernita's daughter comes back to kill Beatrix. But I would actually like to see like a sequel where, like, what is Beatrix's life right now with BB? Like, what are they doing? Like, how did they turn out? Did they go back to El Paso and open a used record store, or are they, like, you know, fly by night assassins who circle the globe and do covert operations for covert organizations? I don't know. And I don't know if she's going to be ultimately happy. And that's kind of the open-ended part.
Yeah, I mean, that's the character. Like, everything she was set up for was revenge. And so we're left with our own. And this is always my favorite thing with movies, is when the movie does not require that something be said about, you know, the future or a tangentially related component, you know, when they leave it open-ended for your own interpretation, I think that we've seen her just in revenge mode, and who knows what's next? Who cares? It doesn't matter. That's up for the viewer to decide, like, where she moves on to, because the facet of her that was destined for the movie is done and over with. And that's true, the laugh. That's that you said, you know, it's the relief. In the end, you know, she did not feel regret. She felt relief, and where she goes from there, who knows?
Yeah. And I it's totally true. And the other part about this is that from the beginning, Quentin Tarantino has told us this is a movie, you know, experience it as a cinematic experience. And therefore it doesn't really matter because Beatrix doesn't exist after the end credits are over. The movie is done. So the story is finished and just chill out about it.
Yeah, and that's why I was saying at the start, like, I wish that Hollywood could do this where the first movie sets up the environment. Stop doing the trilogy thing. Like, everybody wants to do a trilogy right up front. Screw that. Do two films. Do the first one as your world building and then do your film, and then other things can come in later. But trying to drag a movie out over three films, something about the way that that is cut up just does not work. I mean, it's the same. I think Hunger Games had this problem because it was across three books. The first one sets up the world, sets up the rules. Great. Second one, fantastic. You know, how she kind of overcomes that system. And then you can stop there. Don't try and make a weird third disregards everything that has come before it and then shoehorns an ending in. You don't need that.
Right. Exactly. I kind of like that, man. Yeah, Mockingjay Part 1 was the most boring film I've ever seen in my life, by the way.
You could probably skip number 2. It doesn't really get more exciting.
Well, maybe they should have maybe made it one movie instead of two, like, two-hour movies. You can't turn a 100-page book into a two. Anyway, I don't care that much about it, but whatever. just one thing I want to touch on real fast here. The Esteban scene. That was super weird, right?
Oh, yeah.
Like, why was that there?
That's the same guy that plays the sheriff, too, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, the sheriff scene, like, at least leads us to the reveal that,
she lived.
You know, she's still alive, right? But, yeah, like, Esteban... So Michael Parks played Esteban. Michael Parks, he was in like a bunch of movies in like the 60s. Like that's where he started off. So it might be like some kind of, you know, once again, like a callback of Quentin Tarantino being able to direct one of his idols, which is all well and good. But the scene is so strange. The only thing that comes out of the scene is that and you have to listen really carefully because he's so super hard to understand. He is super hard to understand.
I turned the subtitles on so I could fully get what was going on.
The only thing that comes out of the scene is that Bill wants her to come. Like, he's like, I'm going to tell you where Bill is because he would want me to tell you. Like, he wants her. He's welcoming this final showdown. Which is, it's just really, really interesting, man. It's a great way to end the series because it's this weird welcome back reunion. But then it's a foregone conclusion. Like, we know that Bill is going to die. It's literally the title of the movie. So
I like it.
And
I feel like it's the approach to the enemy's lair. In a fantasy movie, like, this is the gates of Bill's, you know, you see just where he came from, because Esteban talks about, you know, knowing Bill's mom, but it is just kind of this lead up, like, good luck, have fun.
No, it is good. I mean, and that whole monologue with Bill at the end of the movie, that's the type of monologue that is, you know, very tropey in like James Bond films, like the villain sits there and tells you everything before the final showdown. But in this one, it works completely because the characters have been built up to this point. There's a reason for everything that's supposed to happen. And so when we do go to the villain's lair and when he does give that final monologue, it's enthralling as opposed to tropey and, you know, rehashed, which, you know, that's what Tarantino does best is he finds the nuggets and the things that have built cinema to where it is today, and then he recreates them and reimagines them in a way that is incredibly interesting and incredibly entertaining. And Yeah, Kill Bill Volume 2, man, it was really good. I really enjoyed my watch through of this movie. All right, buddy. Well, next week we have Death Proof, so I would invite all of our listeners to go to forums.ballmove.com and go to the Death Proof forum. This was part of the Grindhouse series. I'm really excited to revisit it because I don't think I've seen this movie since it was in the theater.
I don't think I have either. I'm going to watch both just for kicks. Since together I think they're maybe 3 hours. So
yeah, give it a shot. So please go to forums.ballmove.com and be a part of the conversation there. And also email us, directpodcast@gmail.com. We'd love to hear your feedback, and we'd love to put it on the air. Until next time, I'm Eric.
I'm Levi.
Cut.